from Washington. This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, what is next following the assassination of an American by IS?
This is another example of how ISIL has miscalculated as to what the world's reaction would be to the savage beheading of a journalist.
British fighters are on the front line of an ISIS information war. The UN says the Syrian conflict death toll is over 191,000, and the sons of an Ebola survivor speak out about their mom's condition. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. The international news outlet that employed assassinated American journalist James Foley says his Islamic State captors demanded $132 million in ransom for his release before they decided to behead him. Foley was a freelance reporter for Global Post when he was captured in Syria late 2012. Global Post said it turned over the demand to U.S. investigators, but the United States does not pay ransoms, as we hear from State Department spokesperson Marie Harf.
We do not make concessions to terrorists. That includes we do not pay ransoms. One of the main ways ISIL has been funded throughout this conflict has been from ransom payments that others have paid. We believe just in 2014, that's in the millions of dollars. So we believe that paying ransoms or making concessions would both put all Americans overseas at greater risk for kidnapping and in harm's way, but that ransoms would also fund and finance exactly the groups we are trying to degrade their capabilities.
U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel expressed regret that the mission to rescue Foley did not succeed after the Islamic State, sometimes referred to ISIL, posted a video Tuesday that showed his beheading in revenge for U.S. airstrikes in Iraq. Secretary Hagel spoke to reporters at the Pentagon.
First, let me offer my deepest condolences and sympathy to the family of Jim Foley, the American journalist who, as you all know, was savagely murdered by the ISIL. As the Department of Defense confirmed yesterday, earlier this summer, the United States attempted a rescue of a number of American hostages held in Syria, including Jim Foley. We all regret that mission did not succeed, but I'm very proud of the U.S. forces that participated in it. And the United States will not relent our efforts to bring our citizens home and their captors to justice. Jim Foley's murder was another tragic demonstration of the ruthless, barbaric ideology of ISIL.
U.S. officials have said intelligence analysts had concluded that the Islamic State video titled A Message to America was authentic. It also showed images of another U.S. journalist, Stephen Sutloff, whose fate the group says depends on how the United States acts in Iraq. Reuters reports the gruesome video presents the Obama administration with bleak options that could define American involvement in Iraq and the public reaction to it, potentially dragging President Obama further into a conflict he built much of his presidency on ending. Once again, U.S. Defense Chief Chuck Hagel.
The president, the chairman, and I are all very clear-eyed about the challenges ahead. We are pursuing a long-term strategy against ISIL because ISIL clearly poses a long-term threat. We should expect ISIL to regroup and stage new offensives. And the U.S. military's involvement is not over. President Obama has been very clear on this point. Our objectives remain clear and limited: to protect American citizens and facilities, to provide assistance to Iraqi forces as they confront ISIL, and to join with international partners to address the humanitarian crisis.
British anti-terrorist police have begun an investigation of the video in which Foley's killer spoke with an accent, which indicated he might be from a certain section of London. Apparently a British national, the killer is just one of hundreds of European Muslims drawn to join Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, who authorities say pose a security threat to U.S. and European interests if they return home from the Middle East. Interpol says the beheading of the U.S. journalist by Islamic State militants shows the need for a coordinated global effort to combat the threat posed by foreign fighters traveling to conflict zones in the region. We asked Professor Charles Dunlap with Duke University for his reaction to that statement.
I think that this is another example of how ISIL has miscalculated as to what the world's reaction would be to the savage beheading of the journalist. I think that they've miscalculated in the sense of the action isn't going to have a a deterrent effect, but rather it's going to focus attention on them in a way that can't possibly be helpful to them. This action by Interpol is exactly the kind of thing that is needed, and I think it'll lead to a more aggressive sharing of information because the world now sees the graphic threat that this organization presents to everyone.
And you can see that also in what the president said. He said the United States will continue to do what it must do to protect Americans. What do you think that might include?
I think what it means is that for the rest of their lives, the people who are involved with this will be hunted by the United States. They will never again have a day when they don't have to look over their shoulder. It will never be over for them, and the United States will continue to hunt them for however long it takes.
If this does set off the international community, what sort of options do they have as far as controlling IS in Iraq and Syria?
Well, I think it's a very tough problem, but it begins with sharing information about the movement of people across borders. And this is why an organization like Interpol is so helpful, because they can be the central clearinghouse, the coordinator, and so forth, limiting these foreign fighters which are moving into the Syria and Iraq area. We have some evidence based on the accent of the individual who killed the journalist that he is likely a foreign fighter. And so that will be the specific kind of threat that I think Interpol will be focusing on. There's a lot of danger when people with Western passports, for example, are members of this kind of terrorist group. And so because they can have access to the West, and that is a threat in and of itself. So this is a great step.
What do you do when you track these people down? Do you detain them?
Absolutely. What I think we'll see is that they will go into the law enforcement process as opposed to, for example, military detention, as we have seen, you know, during the Iraq and Afghan war. I fully expect that these individuals will be handled through the criminal justice system of whatever country they're captured in.
So you don't see this as a beginning road to boots on the ground, as they say, back in Iraq?
Not boots on the ground like we saw before. I would expect that it's quite possible that we would have small numbers of special forces and other government agencies involved on the ground. In fact, we have hundreds of advisors in Iraq right now. But I don't anticipate a large footprint of U.S. troops in Iraq as a result of this.
Professor Charles Dunlap, Executive Director of Duke's Center on Law, Ethics, and National Security. As we reported, security services are racing to identify the Islamic State militant who beheaded the U.S. journalist Foley in Syria because he spoke on camera in English with a British accent. It's estimated that several hundred British citizens are fighting for the Islamic State, also called ISIL or ISIS, alongside thousands of other foreign jihadists. Henry Ridgewell reports from the center of the investigation, London.
O you who believe, answer the call of Allah and His Messenger.
With a soundtrack citing verses of the Quran, a video uploaded on social media in June, purportedly by Islamic State militants, incites Muslims from across the world to come to Syria to fight. One of the militants, who identifies himself as a British citizen named Abu Dujana Al-Hindi, speaks to the camera in English.
This is a message to the brothers who stayed behind. Wallahi, ya ikhwa, you need to ask yourselves what prevents you from coming to the land of Izzah, what prevents you from joining the ranks of the Mujahideen.
The gruesome beheading of American journalist James Foley was carried out by a man with a British accent. Foreign fighters are a valuable asset for the Islamic State, says terror expert Hannah Stewart of the Henry Jackson Society, a British-based policy group.
They might not be the best fighters, but they are the best people in an information war. You can put them on camera and recruit widely from among Muslims in Western Europe. What happens when they join these groups is that they are then further brutalized once they're out in Syria. They may have started with what seemed like a just cause, but they adopt a very extreme ideology once they're out there.
That James Foley's killer had a British accent was no accident, says American filmmaker Bilal Abdul Karim, who has documented the rise of foreigners fighting in Syria.
When Brits or Europeans or Westerners appear in the group, they're very keen to put them on camera so that they can push their narrative. The reason why a British voice was used for this is because they knew the impact that a British voice would make.
After starting out as a militant group fighting local conflicts, the Islamic State is now seeking international recognition, says Afzal Ashraf of the Royal United Services Institute.
What they want is to spread their ideology. They want recognition, they want support, and they will want to get that recognition and support from across the world, but particularly from Western countries.
Another online video from February purports to show a British fighter in Aleppo carrying out a suicide bomb attack on a prison. Britain has been slow to counter extremist ideologies, says Harris Rafiq of the counter-extremism group the Quilliam Foundation.
London, historically over the last few decades, has had Islamist ideology from groups like the Muslim Brotherhood being taught openly without being challenged.
Authorities in Britain and the United States are trying to identify James Foley's killer. The Islamic State's use of online technology provides opportunities for security services, says Professor Peter Neumann of the International Centre for the Study of Radicalisation at King's College London.
They will speak to other foreign fighters on Twitter, on Facebook, on WhatsApp, on Skype. And of course, the intelligence services are monitoring these conversations.
British authorities are appealing to Muslim communities to help identify James Foley's killer. They acknowledge that bringing him to justice will be extremely difficult. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Some of the conflict in the MENA region stems from a dispute between Sunni and Shiite Muslims. VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi asked Professor Gregory Gause, head of the International Affairs Department at the Texas A&M University, about the ancient division.
The split originated in a dispute over leadership of the Muslim community after the death of the Prophet Muhammad. There were those in the community who felt that leadership should fall upon what the leaders of the community thought was the most able individual. In the community, these people came to be known as Sunnis because they claimed to follow the Sunnah, or the way, the tradition of the Prophet. There were those in the Muslim community who felt that leadership should remain within the blood relatives of the Prophet, the house of the Prophet. These people focused on the candidacy of Ali, who was the Prophet's cousin and son-in-law, and they became known as the Shia, from the Arabic Shi'at Ali, the party or faction of Ali.
Sunni and Shia Muslims have lived peacefully together for centuries. What changed that religious divide into a political sectarian divide?
I think that the key issue for the modern tensions and violence between Sunnis and Shia that we've seen in recent years has to do with two things. One is the collapse of some of the alternative ideologies in the modern Arab world, be it Arab nationalism or liberalism, which failed in the past to accomplish their goals. But I think that the more immediate issue now is the collapse of state authority in places like Iraq and Lebanon and Syria, where in the absence of a centralized state, people are thrown back on political and social identities like sectarianism, where they can find security, assistance, and some sense of identity.
But how would the rivalry between Iran and Saudi Arabia impact the political balance between Sunni and Shia in the region?
I basically think that sectarian differences in these places I mentioned are a bottom-up phenomenon. If you had a strong, acceptable state that was doing its job, neither Iran nor Saudi Arabia would be able to meddle in these issues. But I think the collapse of the state has opened up arenas for both Iran and Saudi Arabia and other parties as well, Turkey, Qatar, Israel, to attempt to affect the domestic political conflicts that we see, whether it's in Lebanon, in Syria, Iraq, in Yemen.
What countries would be affected more by that divide between Sunni and Shia?
Well, obviously, it'll be places where there is a history of a divided population on a sectarian basis. I think the most obvious case is Lebanon, where sectarianism has been the basis of the political system since independence. Certain offices of the state reserved for Sunni Muslims, for Maronite Christians, for Shia Muslims. The Lebanese system has sectarianism baked into it. But I think it in Syria and Iraq, with the collapse of centralized authority, we have seen the resurgence of sectarian identity. And those are the other places where I think sectarianism is most important. We also see it in some places where the state hasn't collapsed, like Bahrain, where you have a Sunni ruling family and a Shia majority population. You're less likely to see it, of course, in places where sectarianism isn't an important social element just because there are not that many Shia, like, say, Libya, where you have the collapse of the state, but you don't have sectarian divisions because it's basically a Sunni country. The divisions in Libya tend to be more regional and tribal.
Professor Gary Gause, head of the International Affairs Department at the Texas A&M University. The United Nations says more than 191,000 people have been killed since the start of the Syrian conflict in March 2011. The UN Human Rights Office says probably many more have been killed than the latest report indicates. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The report says its documented death toll has doubled since a year ago. Navi Pillay, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, says the international community's failure to act to stop the killings has been scandalous. Her spokesman, Rupa Colville, says Pillay feels the fighting in Syria and its dreadful impact on millions of civilians has dropped off the international radar.
She goes on to say it's a real indictment of the age we live in, that not only has this been allowed to continue so long, with no end in sight, but it is also now impacting horrendously on hundreds of thousands of other people across the border in northern Iraq, and the violence has also spilled over into Lebanon.
This latest study, the third in a series, is updated through the end of April. It gives the names of the victims as well as the dates and places where they died. Statisticians cross-check the information against other data to wean out duplicate or erroneously reported deaths. The report says the greatest number of documented killings occurred in and around Damascus, followed by Aleppo, Homs, Idlib, Dara, and Hama. More than 85% of the victims were male. However, analysts were not able to differentiate the casualty lists between combatants and civilians. The report documents the killings of 8,803 minors, including 2,165 children under 10 years old. But the authors say the real total is likely higher. Colville says everyone involved in the fighting is responsible for the killings and atrocities being committed. The UN spokesman named the government of President Bashar al-Assad, the military and opposition groups, including militants from the Islamic State group, as complicit in these crimes. And he adds that High Commissioner Pillay says the Security Council must share the blame because it could have done more to reduce the bloodshed.
There are serious allegations that war crimes and crimes against humanity have been committed time and time again with total impunity. Yet the Security Council has failed to refer the case of Syria to the International Criminal Court, where it clearly belongs.
Colville notes that the monthly death toll in Syria remains between 5,000 and 6,000 lives, an extraordinarily high number. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
Two American aid workers who were infected with Ebola have been discharged from an Atlanta hospital here in the U.S. 33-year-old Dr. Kent Brantley and 59-year-old Nancy Wrightbull were infected while working at a missionary clinic in the West African nation of Liberia. The head of Emory University's infectious disease unit, Dr. Bruce Ribner, said they released the patients following standard World Health Organization and Centers for Disease Control and Prevention guidelines.
The standard World Health Organization and CDC guidelines that have been used in the third world have been absence of virus in the blood and patient symptomatically improved for at least 2 to 3 days.
Calling Ebola a fairly devastating disease, Ribner said most patients, if they have not had substantial organ damage, will make a complete recovery. Dr. Brantley is with the medical relief group Samaritan's Purse. Wright Bowl is with the medical missionary group SIM International, which operates the Monrovia Clinic. Today on NBC Television, Wright Bowl's two sons, Jeremy and Brian, were asked by host Matt Lauer what was the first thing their mom wanted to do after she was released.
Rest. Yeah. She was tired and fully recovered, at least from a medical standpoint at the hospital, but ready to kind of slip away and recover with dad and be with him.
You mentioned your dad. I mean, they've been married for, what, more than 40 years. He had to stay behind in Liberia while she was airlifted out to the United States. What was that reunion like?
It was a beautiful time. They were just able to be together and just see one another for the first time in several weeks. So it was really, really good.
I watched Dr. Brantley yesterday at the press conference. He appeared strong and healthy, and he had good color in his face. I've heard reports, though, that your mom is still a little on the weak side. Is that true?
She's tired and trying to rest. There's still some physical recovery that has to go on there, but her color is good and strong.
We spent some time together down in Atlanta, Jeremy, mm-hmm. you and me, and you talked openly and honestly about that image when you saw your mom being carried on a stretcher out of that ambulance at Emory University Hospital. You say you fell to the floor and you started sobbing. I think your dad even said at that point he was thinking about maybe planning a funeral. Mm-hmm. Talk to me about what this ride has been like.
It's been the lowest of lows and at the same time the highest of highs. We've experienced both in thinking about mom's potential death and succumbing to Ebola, but then her recovery and being healed in that way has just brought our spirits up and really encouraged us.
Has she talked to you about her mortality?
A little bit, but you know, her faith is in Christ Jesus, and so that's really where she rests, and so she just really is happy to be healed and out of the hospital.
She and Dr. Brantley are now members of a rather exclusive club, a club that I'm sure neither wants to be a part of.
Right.
But they are now members of a club of people who survived the Ebola virus.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think made the difference? Does your mom think that experimental serum, ZMAP, made a difference? Was it the care at Emory University Hospital? Was it her faith in God?
All three, probably faith mm-hmm. first, and then the care at Emory, and then that product had something to do with it, we think, in some way, but certainly that supportive care at Emory was huge.
And she and Dr. Brantley now share a unique bond.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's something that they'll have for the rest of their lives?
I think so. I think Dr. Brantley is actually kind of part of our family now, and we're part of their family as well.
Is she going to go back, Jeremy?
I don't know.
To Liberia?
She's still thinking about it. She's been talking with Dad about that. The season of rest and recovery for her is something that they want to process that. Africa is still on their heart, and the suffering of the people in Western Africa is still very deep for them. And so maybe through this and their time to recover, that'll give them some clarity on what to do next and where to go.
The sons of Ebola victim Wright Bowl, Jeremy and Brian, speaking with NBC Today Show host Matt Lauer. India has blocked the release of a film about the assassination of former Indian Prime Minister Indira Gandhi, saying it glorifies her killers and could trigger violent public protests. India's certification board said the film lauds the Sikh bodyguards who killed Ms. Gandhi. Certification board chair Leah Sampson said panel members decided the film could not be released because it posed a threat to public law and order. Calm to Hear, or Diamonds of the Community, was scheduled to open today. It tells the story of Ms. Gandhi's Sikh bodyguards who shot the prime minister dead in 1984 in an apparent retaliatory move for a military operation against Sikhs. Earlier in 1984, Ms. Gandhi had ordered army troops into the Golden Temple, the Sikhs' holiest site. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. That's voanews.com. I'm Susan Yockey in Washington.